So this is one of the things I love about Ireland. You literally never know what adventure you're likely to find around the next corner. I was walking in, well, I can't actually tell you where, but I was walking there anyway, and I met a woman doing something really unusual.
You're counting bats?
That's right, bats. The person I met is Dr. Tina Ahi, and she's counting bats that live in an abandoned house that's been fitted out specifically to encourage them to breed.
So I just come down once a month and just monitor the number of bats that are actually in the house.
Did you see any?
Yes, there's 138 in there today.
No way. Brilliant. So you've just somehow managed to count 138 bats in that room?
Yes, you get used to it very, very quickly.
Like, are they in a cave? Are they visible?
They're in the attic space, so I can just let you have a wee peek because they are a protected species and we don't like disturbance. The maternity season, there's no young there yet, but they'll be giving birth over the next few weeks.
Even if I could peek in, it'd be great. Yes, I'd love it.
Indeed.
And so we head inside for a quick look.
It's so dark, I'm tripping over your doggies. <It's okay. laughs> There's a lovely red setter.
Oh, look at that. The ground floor part is literally, this is the winter residence for the bats. So it's been insulated and it keeps below 10 degrees all year round. So the bats need somewhere nice and cold to head in there. And we've created kind of alcoves, wooden alcoves inside to replicate cave-like environments inside there. And there's a lovely little chimney as well where a lot of the bats will go up and they'll roost also.
So we're in this like cold, old, cut stone, limestone house that immediately feels a few degrees colder than outside. And inside, as you say, it's like a half-renovated house. But no one will ever live in this house.
No, because it was a completely derelict. There's no electricity, there's no nothing. It was just a shell. Yeah. And so it's been put to use for the bats.
Impressive.
And so upstairs is literally a double attic space. And again, there's hot boxes inside, maternity hot boxes inside where the female bats will actually give birth to the young. And there's lots of space for them to actually roost as well. So all the bats are up there at the moment. So it's a trapdoor up to it. But you can see the bats can literally go through whatever part of the house they want. Okay, we'll just go up the trapdoor.
So, I see bat poo on the ground.
Yes, bat poo is very distinctive because on contact it actually crumbles.
Huh.
So that's how you can tell the difference between mice poo and bat poo. So, as you know, anything about ecology is all about the poo.
Yeah.
So you see how soft and crumbly, it's almost
that's
like silt.
Right. It's powder, yeah. Right.
Okay.
So I'm a little bit scared, I have to say. Somewhere up here are...
Then why would you be scared of bats?
I think it must be genetic. I have no idea why.
Okay. Right, okay, there's a couple over here.
Oh, look at that. A little hanging from the roof. And it's a lot warmer up here than downstairs. He's aware of us. He or she is looking.
Here, you'll see there's about 20 odd here.
Oh my god. They're all gripping to the chicken wire which is connected to the roof.
Yes. So like this particular species of bat, it's the only free hanging bat in a sense, like in Ireland. So you always consider bats, as you see them in the movies, they're always hanging upside down. These are the only bats that have to hang upside down because they actually can't bend their knees. So they literally have to cling upside down all the time. While the rest of the bats can actually land and crawl in the crevices. Okay, right, that's enough.
That's phenomenal. The things you find as you're walking.
I have to say, that was pretty special. I've never really thought about bats before. And if I hadn't run into Tina completely by chance, I probably never would have. Now, I find myself wondering about their welfare. Concerned, you know? Are there enough of them? Should we be encouraging them in some way, protecting them? That's why I think I shouldn't really tell you where I had my chance encounter with Tina. Tonight, on this final leg of our alphabetical journey through the A to Z of Ireland's natural heritage, we celebrate serendipity. Flights of fancy. Vagaries, or as the Irish say, fagaries. These wonder-filled moments of chance that bring adventure, excitement, and even epiphanies. So last night, our journey took us from P for the people of the past and how they lived with nature, all the way to T, where we met Tony, the man who uses the power of worms and waste to create a vibrant community garden in an abandoned car park. So now we're going to dive straight into U for, well, let's call it Umleitung, which is the German word for diversion. And no, that's not cheating. I set the rules for this A to Z format, okay? So U is for Umleitung, because a while back I was driving through the Burren enjoying the landscape.
So the Burren, you know, it's a limestone landscape, which is the remains, it's like the fossilised remains of the bottom of the sea. And here and there are these hawthorn blooms in most glorious white colour.
And that got me thinking about how little I really know about this countryside.
We always hear about the Burren as this amazing, unique geological area, tourist area in Ireland, but it's really hard to get a sense of the Burren. When you drive through it, you just see sheets of grey stone with the odd bit of hedgerow in between. I want to get underneath the B of the Burren and see why it's there, what it's about, and what is so precious about it.
So it was then that I saw a sign for the Alwi Caves. And I realised this was my chance to have some of those questions answered. So I made my Umleitung, my diversion, and decided to head underground.
Are you all right? Keep the head down a little bit, Mankind. You're tall and
I met Nuala Mulqueeney, and within a couple of minutes we left the sunshine behind and headed into an underworld. We entered this warren of narrow, rounded arch tunnels, gouged out of the limestone eons ago by water. I see occasional abysses falling to further depths and a chasm soaring towards vaulted darkness above. The tunnel is narrow and cramped at times, but you move quickly along an illuminated trail. I expected stalactites and darkness and maybe even waterfalls, but I was not prepared for this.
And Nola, what am I looking at here?
Well, what you're looking at, Mancon, is we're standing in an area that's known as Bear Haven. And in Bear Haven, we are looking at hollows that are scraped out in the ground. And these hollows were scraped out by the European brown bear. It's thought that they were their hibernation pits, or the bear's beds, quite simply. The theory behind it was that they would have come in here to shelter, to rest for the winter time, to hibernate. It's not thought that they lived in here year-round at all, just to hibernate. And the reason for that is there's a constant temperature in the cave, about 10 degrees Celsius, 50 Fahrenheit. And a day like today, luckily on a day like today, it's much warmer outside, so it feels cool in here. But flip that to the winter months, and if it's freezing cold outside, it is noticeably warmer. So we reckon that these bears were clever bears, of course, being from the west coast of Ireland, and they came in here to rest for the winter time. That's what we reckon anyway.
We've just come down like a long corridor to reach this.
Yeah.
So were the bears accessing it from another corridor? How did they get?
No, they weren't. They were because the entrance we came through is the original entrance. And they would have only come in as far as this area because due to light coming in, you know what I mean? Any further it would have been pitch black. Mm. Black. When the cave was being developed to be opened as a show cave in the early 70s, they came across numerous hundreds and hundreds of bones and of remains. It was the bear bones that interested people, all right, because they were so different. There was lots of horse bones, badger bones, hare, rabbit bones, that sort of thing.
Well, how's a horse getting under a cave?
You see, yeah, there's another theory. Now, all this could be tenuous, I know, because there's schools of thought about the extinction times of the bears in the west coast of Ireland as well. They reckon that that could have been a feed kill for the bears and would have dragged it in a certain amount. Now I'm talking about not in this far as here, all along that first passageway, the remains would have been found. And like you said, it took us about 50 walking steps to get into Bear Haven, so it's quite a considerable passageway, you know. So all those remains would have been found at the mouth of the cave and further in. And I know you're going to ask me how old these bear bones are, and again the jury's out on this because of the schools of thought of the extinction of the bears. Do you know what I mean?
No, I don't.
No, you don't. No. I know. The general held feeling is that we had bears roaming around Ireland up until about 1,000 years ago. Mm. Some people will debate that. The reasons for the extinction was, again, it's to do with the landscape. The forests were cut down as men began to hunt them and that sort of thing. That was the reasons for their extinctions.
I'm not 100% sure how old these bones are, is the heel of the story, do you know what I mean? But they're definitely, definitely well over 1,000 years old, could be more.
But these places are interesting time capsules, aren't they?
For sure.
It's a pretty intense feeling to become so intimate with the sleeping place of a bear. It may be long dead, but in the atmosphere down here, you can almost feel the bear's presence. You can just about see it hauling its prey, step by step, all the way down this narrow, rocky crevice. My skin is tingling. Nuala has been taking people through this cave for decades. I wonder if you ever lose that feeling of adventure.
Can you appreciate the wonder of a cave? Like, what does a cave mean to you now?
Well, I mean, it's the underworld of the bourne, isn't it? The overground, it speaks for itself. Do you know? I mean, you see this karstic, moon-like landscape. But because it's limestone, it's very permeable by water, so you have an equally intriguing underground landscape in the bourne region.
And I also learned that around 200 kilometres of underground passageways have been mapped in the Burren. 200 kilometres.
This has always been a mecca for cavers and speleologists and spelunkers, for want of a better word.
Did you make up that word, spelunker?
No, I didn't. Absolutely right, not. It's an Americanism. Absolutely. Yeah. The Americans call it spelunking.
I want to go deeper and get a sense of it.
Yeah, for sure. But we're along the right lines now, aren't we?
There's a palpable intensity to being underground. You can feel the thousands of tons of rock above, the potent aroma of preservation and stagnation, and the constant sound of water trickling, seeping, and coursing through ancient streams and watercourses.
The cave follows the course of an underground river. If I just move my torch over here, and I'll try and explain. Do you see the smaller little how would you call them, rivulets in the
like
limestone?
They're like in a mosque. The slightly lovely carving up and down there.
There's a name on that called anastomosis, and those, would you believe it, are little mini caves, the start of caves. And what happened here was it would have all come out along here, but this part was softer. The limestone was made of softer rock, so that's where the amounts of water would have convalesced and come flowing through and carved out this lovely shape.
It makes you have to imagine the forces of nature working at an enormous power and timescale.
Absolutely.
So what I love is that, you know, when you're driving through Ireland and you're trying to understand the natural heritage of an area, you see the trees and you see the plants and things. But in the Burren, it's vital. All of those rely on what's underground, but we never get to see underground. And there's only one or two times where you can get underground.
That's true.
And then realise that whole complex biodiversity above is actually reliant on this whole system of watercourses.
Absolutely, for sure. Do you know? And I suppose from developing a show cave point of view, we've opened up a little bit of that. And that was the thinking behind it. My dad and Roger Johnson, you know, of kind of interpreting the burn from underground and bringing people to the area to see that in a nicely easy fashion to do that. So we're not the most difficult. We don't have to put on any gear or anything like that. We're steady as she goes. An easy first time caving experience is how we put it.
And so we reach the letter V, which I want to stand for a vagary. Something erratic or unpredictable or extravagant. It's connected to the word vagabond, a wanderer, or vagabonding, the act of heading off on a journey on a whim. Which is exactly what producer Colette Kinsella did one day when she was driving across Ireland. She took a notion to head off adventuring into the unknown.
Now, it's late afternoon, it's around 6 o'clock in the evening, and it's a really lovely sunny evening, and I'm on my way back to Dublin from Cork, and a friend of mine told me that there's a really interesting dolmen to be seen in Carlow, just outside Carlow town. So I'm going to see if I can find it. These days, even when you're heading off into the unknown, ironically, It is handy to have a navigator.
Okay, putting into Google Maps. Hackett's. Hackett's. Am I going on that type? H-A-C-K-E-T-T-S-T-O. Okay, Google has found it. Well, it's found the road anyway, where it is, and apparently the dolmen is visible from the road.
Starting route to Hackettstown Road roundabout.
Okay, off we go.
Head northeast on R639.
I once changed my entire life on a whim when I moved from mainland Europe to the alien and exciting city of Cairo. But never once have I given in to the urge to simply leave the motorway and explore the surrounding countryside. When I see how gloriously green Tipperary, Kilkenny and Carlow are now, I vow to do this more often.
Turn left onto Dunedin Road.
The car whizzes by plantations of wheat and rapeseed, the fields luminous in their green and yellow plumage. I pass tiny villages of thatched stone houses and unabashed beauty. And almost around every bend, there's a 12th century church or Norman castle. The countryside is just full of astounding riches.
Destination is on your left.
And one of the oldest of these riches is probably this dolmen, the Browns Hill portal tomb.
So I've just pulled up into a tiny little car park outside Carlow.
It's in an extraordinary location. I was expecting something more remote, I suppose. But this is a main road. We're close to the town and right beside a school that seems to be having a sports evening. And the dolmen is in the middle of a field of crops.
So the pathway has taken me past a very, very huge field of wheat.
The tomb sits in a perfectly squared off area right in the centre. Apparently it's one of the largest dolmens in Europe. The entire structure is about 2 or 3 times taller than me. The capstone alone weighs 150 tons. And it's as long as a minibus.
Just walking under it now.
But this monument is so much more than just a list of astounding statistics. It's more like a portal. Because when you touch these stones, you can almost feel the long thread of humanity stretching back around 5 or 6 thousand years.
So when you're standing in front of it, you can't help but wonder what those people were like who put it in place.
And what were they feeling when they placed their dead relatives and friends inside? And you also realise, these are the first farmers to use fields just like this one to grow food.
And it's surrounded by the handiwork of Ireland's 21st century farmers. Nice.
I'm so inspired by my vagary, my fagary, that I want more adventures. So it's back into the car to meet up with Gary Brannigan, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of interesting traditions and customs. He takes me to Whitechurch near Rathfarnham in Dublin to see a wart stone.
Is that it, where the water is?
That's it, yeah. It's literally, it's an earth-fast boulder. It's always been here.
Oh. We're standing on the side of what almost looks like a country road, right opposite a small stone church. The pavement is fenced on the inside, but it cuts in to the left in a square space to skirt around a massive boulder with a rectangular hole the size of a tennis ball.
And at one point, a cross sat in it. The cross was gone, and it has the cure for warts. It's said never to go dry. This would have been could have been a high cross at one point, and literally when the cross was taken out, the pedestal that the cross sat on retained some form of sacredness. So the cross would have been early Christian. It could have been 7th or 8th century.
I wonder how it became a wart stone in particular. Like,
it's a bit random. Yeah.
Like, who first realised that their warts had been cured by being around the stone? I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's also extraordinary that people still know about this boulder. And they made sure it was protected when the road and pavement were upgraded. But there's something even more extraordinary in the Phoenix Park on the other side of Dublin.
Here we are in the 15 acres, just opposite the Pope's Cross.
Gary points to a lone tree and says words I never thought I'd hear in the 21st century. That's a fairy tree.
A fairy tree is usually a hawthorn or a whitethorn tree, usually where they grow on their own.
Right.
Now, there's a huge amount of folklore all around the country that you never touch a thorn tree, a whitethorn that's growing on its own, or perhaps if it's growing at a crossroads. It's said that they either dance around them or they use them to find their way home at night.
So what would happen to people if they did go near it?
The fairies would get you.
What did they
do? In a nutshell. Usually what they say is that there would be some form of repercussions.
Yeah.
And that you might have an accident shortly afterwards, or you might even die.
How do you feel about walking over to it?
I'd be good. You're supposed to ask their permission to approach, so I got permission in writing before we came here, so we're all good.
I'm going to follow your lead, so.
But for many, these trees are no laughing matter. People often place offerings on them. And as we get closer, we can see ribbons and rags tied to the branches.
There's a medal.
Oh,
someone has
medals,
left.
Yeah.
And that's a string. And
my God, there's a lot of rags up there, actually, now that I see them. Tied, like very deliberately tied.
Yeah,
handkerchiefs,
yeah.
And bits of silk. And
it doesn't look like there's been people here in a while.
How do you feel when you see that?
I think it's great. You know, we're too serious in a lot of other parts of our life, you know. I think this is great that things like this still exist.
And I do find it sort of comforting that even in our high-tech age of wireless connectivity, people still have faith in the power of nature for whatever.
That's magic.
It's cool, isn't it?
That's magic. 21st century, people still visiting a fairy tree.
Yeah, yeah. Where would you get it, huh?
Gary, I have to say, thank you so much for showing me all these things. They're just fabulous. Little gems.
My pleasure.
Journeys into the unknown are usually surprising and thought-provoking, and I try to encourage myself to take off on a whim more often. And in fact, inspired by Colette, and in search for the next letter on this alphabetical journey through Wild Ireland, I headed off to the Hill of Ward in County Westmeath to think about the letter W. This now forgotten summit was once an important meeting point in ancient Ireland. But I actually came here to reflect on another word beginning with W, one that's been occupying my mind of late.
I've been thinking about wolves. About, you know, one of our native animals that must have had such an impact on this country for so long, until they were eventually wiped out so late, like wiped out in the 18th century, maybe at the very end of the 18th century. And their sign is still so clear on the Irish landscape in place names like Cnoch an Víochtaire, little hill of the wolf, you know, Cnoch an Machtaire. But also the word Breach Wog, the wolf field, or Ach na Breach, the hill of the wolf. Like, it seems that the Irish got on relatively well with their wolves. Like, we see signs of them from prehistory, from Neolithic times with their bones in the bottom of caves. But then in early Christianity, we see saints having conversations with wolves. And we see them in folklore and myth, and then some references to them in the Breton laws, you know, the ancient Gaelic or Celtic laws in Ireland. And it seems the wolves were regularly trapped or hunted here with hounds, with wolfhounds, when they posed a threat to livestock. But otherwise, they were left. But there was always that threat that a wolf could sneak up on you again. And when I was thinking about this, everywhere around here where I live in the Midlands is low. At any point, there could be a wolf in the hedge, a wolf in the forest, a wolf in the ditch or in the bank. And so I've come to one of the highest points in this area of Meath and Westmeath, the Hill of Ward. You can see in every direction, to Wicklow, to Westmeath, and all the way up into Northern Ireland. It's a perfect spot to see if a wolf is coming. There
are records even of these wolves being kept as pets, so they couldn't have been too scared of them. But the thing is, you get a hungry wolf. And that's the thing. Like, wolves thrive in bad times. They did even better when the Normans took over, because the Normans brought battles, and wolves always do well in battles. The tragedy is, you know, the last account is that they were in Carlow. It was a farmer called John Watson who had been suffering sheep losses because of a lone wolf on Mount Leinster. And it's said that in 1786 he killed it with his wolfhound. A few stray wolves, or maybe like hybrids between wolves and dogs, could have survived into the 19th century, into the 1800s. But had they managed to survive up to the famine, up into the 1840s, they would have thrived, unfortunately, you know, after so on, so many human deaths. But they didn't, and they're gone. And while there's talk, I know, of Scotland of maybe introducing them, it's unlikely ever to happen here in Ireland. So instead, I wanted to come up here onto the Hill of Ward to get a sense of what it would have been like to look out into all these directions, north, south, east and west, for as far as you can see, for like tens and dozens and scores, and maybe slightly over 100 miles, there would have been wolves out there. We're on an alphabetical journey through the wonders of wild Ireland. We've left W behind us for wolves and the concept that these howling Mictíre, or sons of the land, could still be loping through the landscape. Now we're in the dregs of the alphabet, X, Y, Z. And X is particularly tough. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea. I mean, there's xanthophile, which causes the yellow in autumnal leaves. Or xylophagus, which refers to insects or mollusks that eat or bore into wood. But I think I'll go for X-rated. As in the X-rated sex lives of orchids. And how these promiscuous, flaunting flowers have evolved the most seductive and duplicitous means of luring pollinating insects to spread their pollen as far as possible. To find out more about the ingenious trickery these sexual sirens of the flower world succumb to, I sought out a botanist, Micheline Sheehy Skeffington.
Micheline, I know very little about orchids, but I'm intrigued by them. Why do they hold such a sway on people?
Yeah, I think there's a whole range of reasons. They tend to grow in areas that are not intensively farmed, so they're rare. They're different colours. I mean, they're nothing like your tropical orchids that you can buy in a florist, which people also like. They're quite magnificent in their shapes and colours and that. So they're some of the things. But they also have interesting pollination mechanisms. So the orchid spike has got a number of flowers together. It's a collection of different little flowers, a bit like a bluebell. You've got a head with lots of little flowers on a stem. And if you look really closely at them, there's a kind of landing pad, which is for insects to land on. There's often markings, which are guidelines, which guide the insect into coming and getting the nectar. Yeah. And then all orchids, instead of having anthers which shed pollen liberally, as often you'll see a bee covered in pollen from that, they've got two little club-shaped structures. And they will end up on a bee's head. And they'll fly around in these club-shaped structures, then dry out and the pollen starts to shed. Your bee goes to another flower, sheds some pollen. So the bee is actually carrying the whole anther, the whole stamen structure with its pollen in its pollen sacs around from one orchid to another.
Whoa.
bees tend to be very specialist in their visiting habits. Mm. You probably know the honeybee, they tend to go, let's go and do the rosemary today. You know, a bee comes back and says there's lots of nectar. So they might be doing all the orchids in one go. It'll go from one orchid to another, and the hope from the orchid's point of view is that it's the same species and that it doesn't waste pollen on another species of orchid or on another flower. Obviously, it can visit other things.
But the ingenuity can go even further, deep into the realm of sexual deception.
Take the bee orchid as an example. If you look at the lower lip of one flower as a spike with maybe 6, 7, 8 flowers on it, and the base of it is kind of furry and round and looks like the abdomen of a bee. Uh-huh. And the upper petals are pink, so it looks like there's a bee on a pink flower.
So would a bee not just think, oh, there's a bee already on that flower, I'll go elsewhere, you know, to get...
No, there is another thing that they do. They produce what are called pheromones. Huh. And the pheromones mimic those of a female bee or wasp. In the case of the fly orchid, it's actually a wasp.
So a male wasp or a male bee will come to that orchid then... What, to impregnate the pretend female?
It thinks it's a female, and it comes, particularly let's take the fly orchid. The male wasps emerge before the female wasps. There are then fly orchids in flower. Male flies around, smells the female wasp, sees a shape which looks like a female wasp. In this case, the fly orchid even has a little blue patch which looks like shiny wings folded over. And there are two little antennae, so it looks just like that. Comes, lands, attempts to mate with the flower.
Ingenious. And this is at a time of the year where there are no female wasps.
Exactly.
So it's like
so
gagging
like, okay, first. Yeah, this is a female, it must mate, you know, that's it. And obviously then in so doing, it doesn't actually mate with it, but it takes it might hit up against the little pollen sacs and they will become detached and the bee will fly off and probably see, there's another one, I'll try again. And fly orchids are pollinated in that kind of way.
That's so Machiavellian.
Yeah.
The sophistication of a plant to totally mimic an insect.
Yeah.
Which is not just the look, but the smell too.
The smell, and they've done experiments where they've put a paper bag over the orchid and you'll see the male wasps flying around. I can smell a female.
Oh, they're not seeing it.
So they don't see it, but they can smell it. So you know that there's a smell emitted.
How the hell does that happen?
I'm shocked by its deviousness and awed by its ingenuity. But it's not only the poor bee who sees an apparition of sexual anatomy in the flower. The word orchid derives from the Greek for testicle. To us humans, the twin tubers look like male sexual organs. Indeed, the surgical removal of the testes is still called an orchidectomy. Over centuries, we've been totally seduced by the plant, and we're now one of its principal pollinators. Humans are responsible for more than 100,000 registered hybrid orchids, most of them literally inconceivable without us. Even the names we give them are somewhat kinky. Ladies' tresses. Ladies' slippers. They radiate desire and allure. Of course, its characteristics arose from random accidents of the evolutionary process over eons. But you've got to wonder, what are the chances that a flower deemed sexy by a handful of witless insects would also be deemed arousing by us humans? Weird. Could the orchid represent the line at which our erotic impulses blend with those of the insect world? Anyway, moving on. If the orchid fails to subduce some poor unwitting insect to pollinate it, or to persuade us humans to do the deed, they still have one other ingenious trick to ensure survival.
If it hasn't got pollen by the time the flower is fading, it can be self-fertile. So it has delaying mechanisms, if you like, to make sure that its self-pollen doesn't germinate as fast and maybe doesn't even become ripe until maybe an insect's come with pollen from another one. But the fallback for most plants, particularly the insect pollinated one, is self-pollination.
Micheline, that has left me just more mystified. I knew orchids had a particular mysteriousness to them, but that's actually mind-bending. That there's a level of sophistication going on there that I can't even wrap my head around.
Well, they're the most evolved, if you like, of the higher plants. Orchids and actually grasses as well, believe it or not. But grasses are totally different because they're pollinated by the wind.
I'm still trying to deal with orchids. Leave me on orchids.
They've got incredibly sophisticated flowers.
It's beautiful and it's humbling.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating.
Thanks, Micheline.
On this episode of Monkland's A to Z of Ireland, we're celebrating serendipity. Those moments of chance that give you new and unexpected insights into the natural world. Or adventures that reveal interesting characters and customs. And this is exactly what happened to Colette Kinsella when she was wandering through the Shandon area of Cork City. She came across a father and son creating something delicious from what used to be an Irish natural resource, shukra. So our next letter on this alphabetical journey can only be one thing. Y for yumminess.
I'm making a programme for RT for Heritage Week. I just saw you making sweets here. Could I have a look around?
Oh, I hate my accent.
Dan Linehan's shop looks like an old-fashioned, tiny sweet shop that sells hard-boiled sweets. But oh boy, it's so much more.
It's the smallest sweet factory and the oldest sweet factory in Cork, in Munster, if not further afield.
And when you go through the wooden half gate and walk about 12 paces to the right, you land right in the middle of the action. There's a stove at the back wall and Dan's son Tony is watching a copper pot boiling ever so furiously.
And I'm smelling like boiled sweets, this lovely sugary smell.
Yeah, basically what we're doing there now is boiling up the batch.
So you have these two big, are they copper pots?
Oh, they're like copper pots. We've used copper pots for as long as I'm here, and my father was here before me. You see, the copper pot gives, so they say, better flavour.
So what ingredients do you have in there?
Yeah, there's sugar, glucose and water in that one now. Ah. 90% of the sweets we make are sugar, glucose and water.
And how do you flavour them?
Oh, we have all different natural colours and flavours, which are all along the shelf there.
So what flavour is this batch going to be?
What we're actually making is rhubarb and custard.
Oh, so you're like a little mini Willy Wonka in this part of Cork.
The shop is L-shaped and there is what looks like a long metal countertop stretching off to the left of the cooker. This is the cutting table. It's got a rim on it all the way around and the surface is heated. The room is just slightly wider than the table. Framed pictures of GAA teams hang on one wall, and three shelves run the length of the other.
You have batches of colour and oil and shelves with all these flavours,
yes.
And loads of look like ancient scissors hanging down there.
Well, we use a lot of different scissors for different cuttings, but you can't buy those scissors anymore because they're extra long shears on them. I feel that's...
Oh, so we're feeling the cutting table, that's greased?
It's greased, but I also have to heat it.
Okay.
Because the table would be too cold to work with. Stuff will crack. It's all timing.
Meanwhile, the glucose sugar mixture is done. And Tony pours a white hot liquid onto the table.
That has boiled out to 300 degrees. And now it's been dropped onto the table. And you can see it's not to be played with.
The liquid spreads all the way to the rim and looks just like a pane of glass.
Exactly, know what you said. That's what they do in films. Much the same. A fella burst out the pane of glass yourself.
The molten liquid thickens a bit as it cools and Tony gathers it up like dough.
Tony's folding it.
Yes, you have to turn it over 3 or 4 times to get it pliable. Then you add your colours and flavours.
Tony makes a few indentations in the dough with his thumb. Pours on a glug of liquid, then kneads it through.
That's an acid now he's just throwing on there. Give it a zip flavour. Yeah.
As the mix cools, it takes on the consistency of plasticine.
So now you're actually slicing the folded stuff with big shears and you're folding the two bits again. How heavy is that?
About 20 kilo. After 8 hours you do feel a bit tired. Yes.
Tony keeps kneading for several minutes, his wiry upper body leaning in over the table.
Then he reaches up to the shelf behind. And you have there what looks like paint pots.
Food colours, that's what they are.
And you're painting on some red now onto one half of the mixture. Bit of blue on there now too. And then here comes the flavour. Indentations with your finger and on it goes. So you didn't actually measure that flavour?
You know.
You know.
After 33 years, I think I know by now.
Now you're spinning it and kneading it like and folding it like bread dough almost. And that colour is just, oh, just rippling through it beautifully. It's getting so red and bits of blue. Oh, that's just gorgeous now. It's glistening and it's like enamel colour. Beautiful. Ah, I can smell that flavour. It's gorgeous. Scissors comes out. Slicing off a bit. So you're mixing up bits of the unflavoured.
The other colour, the second colour, yeah.
Don't tell our Tony secrets. We'll have to kill her.
That is such physical work, Tony. I'm not surprised there's not a pick of fat on you.
Plus, I don't eat them. Yes. That's the secret as well. You don't need much gym membership in this job. No.
Tony now has what looks like two glass pancakes. One a lustrous red, the other a dazzling yellow.
They have to be bright.
Now I get it. The yellow is going on top of the red. Two triangles being squished together. And that gives the rhubarb and custard, right? And now a brass moulded instrument that'll make it into sweets is coming out onto the table. Tony attaches what looks like two brass mangle ringers to the end of the cutting table. Except the ringers aren't smooth. They have indentations in them, the shape of sweets. A big old slice of that mixture is being pressed through this ringer. And the sweets come out shaped yellow and lovely red. And a brand new batch of Shandon sweets is ready to rock. Oh, there's a tiny little piece on the table that I can pick up and taste. Mm, still warm. Oh, it's good. Mmm. Make sure I don't pull my fillings out.
You're listening to Moncon's A to Z of Ireland, where we've been following an alphabetical trail through the odd and unusual, the alluring and inspiring of Ireland's natural wonders. And so we come to the final leg on this journey. And for this story, we, the producer Colette and I, decided to get into the car and see if we could come up with a piece of heritage beginning with Z. And as it turns out, we found a perfect example, one that offers a neat insight into humankind's attitude to a very important natural process. In fact, it could even be the most important process on which the entire natural world depends. Death.
So, where are we heading now, Moncon?
We're heading east towards Boyle. We've come from Mayo, now we're going through the south of Sligo, and we're going to an archaeological dig, actually, by a man, Chris Reed, an archaeologist. But I'm not so interested in his current archaeological dig, but like that's always worth it. So it could be A for archaeology or S for stone, because what I want to find out is this man dug up some skeletons, some like really ancient skeletons, as far as I know, maybe from 700 or 800 AD, a few years ago. And found something extraordinary in their mouths, like something that led to a mystery. And so I want to know more about that. I want to know more about humans who are hard to kill, humans who don't necessarily die, and you need to make sure they stay dead. So that's it. I'm going to an archaeological dig, A for archaeology, D for dig, to find out about the dead and the undead.
And we meet Chris Reed.
That's my car. And
the person at the centre of the story about the undead beginning with Z.
Moncon.
Chris. Yes, I am.
Can you guess what it is yet?
Chris.
We meet him in Moygara Castle in County Sligo.
So you found it okay.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant.
We did.
Chris is a tall, tattooed redhead. and he's also a lecturer in archaeology in IT Sligo.
I'm at my, I think, my very first ever archaeological dig.
Seriously?
Since I was eight. At eight, I was in Wood Quay, like trying to stop the bulldozer.
And the story we're about to hear happened when he was excavating the ruins of a bishop's palace in Kilteeshan in County Roscommon back in 2011, which was when they got their first surprise.
What we thought was the palace turned out to be a fairly well-organised and managed cemetery.
And this turned out to be one of the most exciting elements of the site.
Because amongst those burials that we found, two of the earliest ones, so probably dating somewhere between 700 and 800 AD, they were found side by side, and both of them had large stones wedged into their mouths.
This is what archaeologists call a deviant burial.
We use the word deviant burial to refer to any burial which deviates from the norm.
And the norm in the Christian tradition does not involve ramming stones into a person's mouth before burial.
It was really quite a violent act. One of them was so large that it would have, if the person was, it dislocated the jaw. But from what we can tell, the people were well dead when it happened.
And what were you thinking? Are you immediately jumping to ideas? Or like, so you, we don't expect to see stones in people's mouths.
No. But we do know from other excavations, people had a fear around bodies returning from the grave. This seems to be almost universal, and Irish folklore is full of stories of what we call revenants. And a revenant is basically just a reanimated body. And so what we kind of imagine, because these medieval burials are really shallow, just enough to cover the person. So if somebody wasn't quite dead yet, you know, and their understanding of death, comas, that kind of thing. So if somebody managed to claw their way out of their grave and go stumbling around the place, it would have been quite a sight. The thing about the stones is the general belief was that when you died, your soul escaped your body through the mouth. And the idea about the stone was to either keep that soul from getting back into the body because they weren't ready to be dead yet, or possessed by an evil spirit of some sort.
Basically, it's proof of a culture not quite believing someone was entirely dead or someone could come back.
Or, like, if you just think of ghost stories and things like that, there's...
It's zombies, basically. It's someone coming out of the grave again. Yep. It's a bit of flesh, half rotted.
I'm having a hard time getting my head around the fact that there might have been zombies wandering around medieval Ireland. Actual zombies. My Z in this alphabetical array of natural heritage. It's just perfect. Except... Chris insists they're not zombies.
Okay, so these are, so there weren't zombies found basically in Lochee.
No.
But you say they are, they're revenants, and revenants are fleshy. What do you mean?
Meaning like literally if a body were to climb out of the grave and go stumbling around, it's a fleshy body, unlike a ghost, which is an ephemeral spirit. A zombie, I suppose, is very specifically a Haitian kind of version of a revenant, and that's been picked up by popular media in the last number of years with video games and movies and TV shows. But zombies, really specifically a Haitian voodoo kind of revenant, a magically sort of reanimated body for, you know, ritual purposes or whatever. Yeah.
So these revenants, and what you say, there's other proof for them in Irish culture in some way.
In Irish culture, there's a brilliant story of an ancient Irish chieftain who lived in Armagh, and he was a dwarf and was very, very cruel to his subjects. So apparently his subjects went off to a neighboring chieftain and asked him if he would come and challenge their guy to a battle, and if he won, they would, you know, willingly be his subjects. So your man came, challenged him to a battle, killed him, buried him, everybody was happy, but then he crawled out of the grave the next day and went wandering around with a bowl looking for blood. So this happened a couple of times until eventually the other chieftain went to consult a saint or the druids, depending upon the version, and he was told that the body had to be buried upside down, wrapped in rope, killed with a wooden sword, wooden stake through the heart kind of thing, and then buried with large stones on top of it. So, like, that's just one example of a belief in revenants and the sort of things that were done to try to keep the person in the ground. So stones and mouths or other things aren't a big stretch from that. But some people believe that this story was probably known by Bram Stoker, who, as we know, lived in Ireland.
And so the idea is we're all familiar with these things now because of ghost stories, because of horror movies, but you're saying at a time where that line between fact and the other world wasn't as clear,
yeah,
then they weren't just fiction, they weren't just adventure, they were
it was almost a truth. There would have been, I'm sure, a few strange examples of people coming back from the dead, but I suppose more than anything it shows where I suppose it's rife in popular culture now, but you go back to the early 20th century, the 19th century, these are the stories people shared around the fire. Mm. And it just goes to show how long those stories have been part of our culture.
Yeah. And do we have any sense of who these people would have been? Who ends up with a stone in his mouth?
That's one of the more interesting things. We now know that both of them were young men, okay, so somewhere around 20 years old, and exceptionally tall. So 6'3", 6'4". And the average height of men from our cemetery is about 5'8". So these guys were big. And they had quite a lot of indications sort of in the bones that they led relatively strenuous lives. So they could have been laborers or they could have been warriors. So they could have been enemies. The thing about deviant burials is the word deviant refers specifically to them being buried in a different way. But it also sort of takes on a meaning of who gets buried in a different way. Very often it would be murderers, rapists, somebody who died of a mysterious disease, somebody who died violently, suicides, those kinds of things. Anybody who died unnaturally. And not knowing causes of death terribly well back then, you can imagine there would be a good few of them.
So it's either a warrior or an outsider. It's someone who wasn't embraced by the community.
Yeah, or maybe they were embraced by the community, but something strange and terrible happened to them, which made their loved ones or the people left behind afraid that something might happen. The division between fact and fiction, even today, I suppose, is terribly blurred. But back then, you know, we can only imagine the types of things that people believed.
So I don't know. I mean, it's reassuring if you're telling me there were no zombies in Roscommon. But at the same time, you're saying, no, there definitely were no zombies in Roscommon, but there were fleshy revenants. Like, it's a thin line. I don't know if I'm going to sleep any better, Chris.
Well, I don't think things have changed that much. I mean, we humans have always, some people would argue, always have had a fear of death. People's relationship with death in ancient times and even right up to more current traditions, you know, the washing of the body with you know, Irish wakes and things like that. Nowadays, with modern type funerals, once a person's died, their body's whisked away. You might see them a bit at the funeral and then they're gone. People's relationship with the dead was much stronger in the past. So we're kind of disassociated from that. Our fears of the dead are, I suppose, more focused on our own mortality rather than, you know, weird and wonderful and magical things.
It's just this hope that we neither of us end up with a stone in our mouth.
Well, I'm hoping, because I'm the one who dug them up, and I keep thinking that it would be a perfect, perfect storyline for a bad horror movie, you know, just walking down the corridors of the archaeology lab and, you know, icy fingers, that kind of thing.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
No problem. You're welcome.
And that was it for A to Z of Ireland. Our alphabetical journey through some of the more outlandish, unusual, and unique aspects of Ireland's natural heritage. Over 5 episodes, we've listened to the sounds of nature. From bird songs to the battles of bats. From howling wolves to hissing sea snails. We've savoured the taste of the land with heat flowers, heather and hazelnuts captured in vinegars and ice cream. We've buried eggs and burrowed for bears. We went scuba diving and straw stalking. And there's been cuckoos and curlews, disappearing lakes and denizens of soil. But in truth, we've barely scratched the surface of what's out there. These programmes were hardly an A to Z of anything, really. Just an index of some of the riches awaiting our exploration. Go now, get out of here, stop listening to this radio and continue the journey yourselves. delve deeply, desperately, demonically even, into the bounty of nature that surrounds us all on this emerald Atlantic island.